Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut, joining you for another busy day on the show. We've got really significant breaking news from the Washington Post. They moved a story within the last few minutes about Tom Price. We'll get to that in a moment, but first let me introduce our panel today. Kyle Wingfield, columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. You are in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays. You're not moving to Wednesday like your colleague Galloway, are you?
I'm not. I guess they had to split us up, you know, break up the Yankees, right?
I'm glad you could be here. Do you already know what your next column is going to be about?
It's already done.
What is it?
It's a pop quiz like those that you get online sometime.
So like when I read about who my perfect date would be, mate would be in Cosmopolitan or something?
It'll tell you where you ought to live.
Really? Like you mean in the Atlanta metro area in Georgia?
A little more generic than that. Well, just read it and find out. Okay. How's that for a plug?
I love that. Melita Easters is here. She is the founder and director of the Georgia Win List, which is an organization dedicated to finding women Democratic candidates who are pro-choice to run for office. Melita, welcome. And you have an event that we're all going to be paying very close attention to coming up next Monday. Tell us about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill. Our event is a candidate conversation between the two women who are gubernatorial candidates in 2018, Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans. They'll take the stage for the first time to answer questions posed by former Secretary of State Kathy Cox. We'll also be introducing eight women whom we have endorsed either for 2017 primaries or early endorsements for the 2018 contests.
And these are like legislative races and the like?
Yes. We have an almost record-setting number of state legislative seats which are open and will be voted on at the same time as the municipal elections in November. And there are five of those races where we have endorsed women. And then we have two statewide candidates we've endorsed for 2018 and a legislative candidate as well.
All right. You have really won on this one. To get to see Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans face off for the first time, there's already a great competitive spirit and a lot of tension between them. We'll get a first opportunity to hear how that's going to play out. Congratulations on that. This is open to the public. It's at the Carter Center.
It's a ticketed event at the Carter Center, but certainly we want all the media to come. And it will be a fun way for people to see where these two women stake the differences between them. And, you know, when two or five or four men are running for the same office, there's none of this hand-wringing about, oh, I wish they wouldn't go against each other, the way you hear about these two women. We at WinList celebrate the fact that we were founded on the idea that someday there would be a great woman governor of Georgia, and now we have two choices, and we celebrate that.
Okay, running against a field of, one of them will run against a field of Republican candidates who will be talking about, obviously, as the campaign continues to get more and more attention. Also joining us today, Andy Miller. Are you the founder of Georgia Health News, by the way?
I am. I have a lot of other jobs as well. President, CEO, editor, cafeteria worker, all that sort of stuff. But yes, we started 7 years ago, though.
Well, we're glad to have you here. There's so much to talk about in health news today, and we're going to get to that in the next couple minutes. So thanks for being back with us again today, Andy.
Glad to be here.
But we need to start with an important story that the Washington Post broke just about a half an hour or so ago, and it relates to the Tom Price travel controversy. You all who pay attention to the headlines, certainly you've heard it on this show. Tom Price, Politico, has really dug into this story about the many charter flights that Tom Price has taken as HHS secretary, something like two dozen since going into office, spending more than $400,000+. In many cases for flights that Politico reports they found could just as easily have been made by commercial aircraft without too much inconvenience. And then most recently, Politico has dug even further into this and found there are a couple trips that seem to involve just personal. Kyle, one of them is he went to the He and his wife took a trip to their house at St. Simon, I guess it is.
His house is Sea Island.
Sea Island. That's okay.
There's a difference.
Yeah, there's a big difference. So Sea Island. And then another apparently to visit his son. And this is getting a little bit more intense. And let me just tell you what the Post is now reporting. And I'll read you the lead. President Trump said Wednesday he is, quote, not happy about revelations concerning Tom Price. Responding to questions from reporters, Trump said he is, quote, looking into the situation and, quote, personally, I'm not happy about it, and I let him know it. He said before that he's not happy about this and that he's looking into it. But what's new is this. The president appeared to suggest he'd consider firing Price, saying, quote, I'm going to look into it, after a reporter asked about Price's future. It was not completely clear if Trump was answering that direct question. Later, though, asked about whether he would fire Price, Trump said, we'll see. Kyle, how much trouble is Tom Price in over all this?
Well, that depends on if he's in Jeff Sessions-type trouble or Anthony Scaramucci-type trouble. I mean, we've heard this president make similar comments about members of his staff several times already in this relatively short presidency. You know, the one thing that Price does not have going for him right here is that this comes at a perilous time, you know, when you look at the failure to pass a health care bill so far, and he was seen, obviously, as someone who was going to play a big role in that. I don't know how much of a role he's actually been given, but certainly from an optics standpoint, it does not look good to have your Health and Human Services Secretary doing this. At the same time, you're failing to move the ball on a repeal of Obamacare.
Well, when the story first, when Politico first reported the story and then the Washington Post picked it up, Melita, both news organizations had information from White House officials, anonymously sourced, of course, saying that they wondered why Tom Price was doing all this flying around at a time when they were making one more push on health care. If he's in trouble, as Kyle seemed to suggest, it could be just as much about whether he was there for the team on health care.
Or whether anybody really likes him. He's not the most likable personality to ever serve in Congress from Georgia.
Yeah. Andy, what are you hearing about Price's involvement in health care?
Well, he was on the Sunday talk shows, a lot talking about the repeal and replace efforts. And a lot of that legislation was targeting Medicaid, which is for low-income people and disabilities. So here you really have a perception problem when you have the secretary flying these charter planes and then you're looking at reductions to programs for the poor. I mean, it just doesn't line up that way.
Well, we're going to have to watch this play out. But it does strike me that Trump has got to, you would imagine, perhaps, that the president is looking at, Steve Mnuchin had some issues with charter travel. So that's not played particularly well. What's interesting about that, though, is that when Mnuchin's travel came up, his trying to use a charter plane, a government plane for his honeymoon, and then he did use one to take his wife to Kentucky to watch the total eclipse, the president gave him a pass. The president, being asked about that, said, well, I think he resolved that, something to that effect. He is not saying that about Tom Price, which just in and of itself strikes me as making it more significant.
Well, it's also kind of like in a football game when the referee sees the second guy pushing, you know, and doesn't see the first one. Maybe you wanted to be the first guy to get caught for this and not the second one, because, you know, the first one, maybe you can give somebody a pass, and the second one, you don't want it to become perceived as this is a problem in your administration.
But it's also the number of trips Price took and the obviously personal reasons for taking some of them.
Yeah. I think if I were the president, oh, go ahead, Andy.
Well, I was about to say that Mnuchin is kind of like Trump's type of guy. You know, he's like very wealthy and, you know, investment banking background, I believe. And Price is from a different background. I mean, he's a surgeon and things, but he doesn't have that kind of high-end wealth issue going for him that Trump seems to like in people.
Yeah. All right. Well, that story is certainly going to develop even further, and we'll watch as it does. Let's turn to another story that is in the headlines today, and that is the victory of outsider Roy Moore in the GOP Senate primary in Alabama, beating the candidate backed by President Trump and by leader Mitch McConnell, Luther Strange. Last night, Roy Moore accepted victory, doing it the way he would do it. It's all about God.
Don't let anybody in the press think that because he supported my opponent that I do not support him and support his agenda. But we have to return the knowledge of God and the Constitution of the United States to the United States Congress. This is a time for victory. It's a time to remember the struggles we've gone through, but it's also time to rededicate our lives to God and to the Constitution and to our country, to our families. Let's go again and make America great. Thank you. May God bless you.
Kyle, what are the implications of this anti-establishment Republican beating the mainstream swamp-dwelling Luther Strange for the Republican Party?
Well, I think kind of like with Georgia 6th, we need to be a little cautious about applying this race, the dynamics of this race elsewhere. I mean, for one thing, with Luther Strange, he clearly, if you read the coverage from the state, he clearly was tainted by this arrangement of his becoming a senator made by former Governor Bentley, who was in the middle of a corruption scandal, or a scandal there, and Luther Strange was the Attorney General of Alabama, and so when you read the press in Alabama talking to voters there, when I've read that, it's very clear that weighed heavily on them, and they weren't really seeing this as a Trump versus non-Trump thing. I used a football analogy earlier. This is kind of like if Alabama dressed out both sides in the Iron Bowl and then they played each other. You know, there might be a contest, but neither of them is Auburn against Alabama. These were two players on the same side.
Yeah,
really.
But this is a defeat for President Trump, isn't it, Melita?
I don't see it as too much of a defeat because Trump, in his rambling off the rails hour and a half speech in Alabama last Saturday, sent a clear dog whistle to the people who supported Roy Moore by saying, I might be making a mistake in talking about Strange.
There's the way you want to be endorsed.
Faint praise like that you never want in a political campaign. And so Trump was, at the same time he was appearing on a stage with Luther Strange, he was strangely sending a dog whistle to all those people who would crawl out from under their rocks for Roy Moore and cast their votes for him.
If there's an implication for Trump here, it's that if you're endorsed by him, you're going to get the baggage that comes along with him. And then to know that at least once, he's gone and basically, as Melita says, gone on a stage and said, you know, I might be backing the wrong guy. I'll be for either one of them. You know, that it's kind of a risk to align yourself with him and then to have him basically pull the rug out from under you in the end.
And Roy Moore, you know, he was removed from the state Supreme Court of Alabama twice mm-hmm. for disrespecting federal court orders.
Yeah, it is a little interesting to hear Roy Moore talk about his defense of the Constitution in his speech last night. Andy, Roy Moore was removed from the court first because he wouldn't take down a huge, very heavy display of the Ten Commandments in stone from the state Supreme Court building when a federal court ruled it was in violation of the U.S. Constitution, and then was removed a second time after having been elected back to the Supreme Court when he told judges in Alabama to disregard the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on gay marriage and told them not to marry gay people.
Yeah, Bill, I think that this election shows the voting strength, the considerable voting strength of evangelicals. And it's here in the South, it's here in Georgia, and it's definitely here in, there in Alabama. I think that these people turned out for their Ten Commandment protecting candidate.
So it's going to be interesting to watch. He's almost certain to win the general election, although he's running against an interesting Democrat, former U.S. attorney, who actually prosecuted the KKK members who were responsible for the Birmingham bombing, church bombing, that killed four little girls back in the early 60s. They weren't brought to trial for many years after that. So Democrats are trying to figure out whether they really want to get engaged in this race or not. But it's still Alabama, isn't it, Kyle?
Look, anything can happen, right? But I think it'd be shocking if Moore were to lose this. You mentioned about the Constitution and all that. Yeah, so I covered him back during the first controversy. I was based in Montgomery, and that's how he talked about that case. He believes his view of the Constitution is more correct than the ones that these federal judges are handing down. He doesn't necessarily accept the idea that the federal courts are superior to a state Supreme Court, which is constitutionally questionable. But that's where he's coming at from in that. I mean, he will quote the Founding Fathers at length, way too long if you're a newspaper reporter trying to quote him. That's a long time thing for him.
But also, I think he believes that the Constitution takes a back seat to the Bible, and he's a Bible thumping evangelical who kind of believes not in interpretations. He takes his scripture straight up and down. And you know, the one thing missing from your very well-edited clips at the beginning was the fact that the song they played for Roy Moore to come out and accept his nomination was How Great Thou Art.
Yeah, okay. One last question, before we have to take a break and then move into our healthcare conversation. And Kyle, you sort of referred to this already. You are absolutely right, I think, to say that we have to take every single race on its own terms. There is a dynamic to every single individual election contest that cannot be ignored, and that you cannot necessarily extrapolate that it's going to have an impact on races all around the country, or there are going to be similar dynamics. That said, certainly Roy Moore's victory over Luther Strange does seem to me to be and Steve Bannon would say this, to be a sign that those really hardline conservatives who want to take on Republican incumbents who are mainstream in 2018, they're getting encouragement as a result of this victory.
I tell you, the thing that happened yesterday that I think points in that direction more is the retirement of Senator Bob Corker of
Tennessee, a mainstream Republican, very well respected.
And you know, he said at the outset he was only going to serve two terms, and et cetera, et cetera. But I have to think that is a sign that he sees that there is, beyond the dynamics of an individual race, that there is sort of a trend here. Yeah, and to me, that is a clearer sign than, again, what I saw as sort of two sides of the same coin in Alabama. You would see a much more much bigger ideological gap, I think, between a hardcore conservative challenger to Bob Corker in Tennessee.
Yeah, and I think Tennessee is going to end up being a very interesting race. You know, you've got to wonder, Melita, for Republicans like a Bob Corker, this just isn't fun anymore. And beyond being not fun, which really ought to be a little bit which is something worth considering, you're not getting anything done. Why do you want to stay there at a certain point?
I think that is very, very true. And the Senate will miss Corker as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But you see the same thing happening in state houses all over the country. When you have the divisiveness that we have here in Georgia, there are a number of women legislators we lost because they just didn't want to put up with having to be in a one-sided state capital anymore. So certainly public officials, even though they may be admired, can reach a level of, why am I doing this? I'd rather spend time with my grandchildren.
All right. We got to get a break in today at this point in the show. When we come back, we really have a lot to talk about in terms of health care. We'll do that when Political Rewind continues.
President Trump rescinded DACA, a program allowing undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to remain here. There is a grace period, but people have to apply by next week.
I see pictures of people's passports and their little babies on their passports when they have a stamp of having entered, you know, or maybe they're a year or two old.
Thousands of Georgians face the deadline. Where can they get help? Find out tomorrow on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. GPB News, stand with the facts.
Kyle Wingfield, the conservative columnist from the AJC, we always point out we're not the ones affixing that label. The paper does it. You have conservative columnists and liberal columnists, and you're on the conservative side of the line that they draw in the paper, right?
That is correct.
Okay, yes. Mr. Conservative. The progressive liberal Melita Easters joins us, founder of the Georgia Win List, and Andy Miller, founder, CEO, editor-in-chief of Georgia Health News. Of course, yesterday afternoon, as we launch our conversation about health care, the big story was that the third major effort in the United States Senate, the Lindsey Graham-Bill Cassidy bill that would repeal and replace Obamacare, finally went up in flames when it became clear that there just weren't enough people to vote for it. Yesterday afternoon, Cassidy and McConnell stepped in front of the microphones and said this.
We don't have the votes. Okay. That's, and speaking to the leadership, speaking to the president, I think Lindsey and he are on speed dial. We've made the decision, since we don't have the votes, we will postpone that vote. Okay. Am I disappointed? Absolutely.
We haven't given up on changing the American healthcare system. We are not going to be able to do that this week, but it still lies ahead of us, and we haven't given up on that.
They haven't given up. Andy, do you really expect that Republicans will come back? Certainly it's not going to be this year. They've got too many other things to accomplish. Do you see them coming together and trying to figure out a way to do this again? They no longer have the ability to do it with 50 votes.
I think they will come back again, and it may be multiple times before the congressional election next year. I think it's, you know, they're just dead set on getting rid of Obamacare, the majority of the GOP senators. But I thought it was pretty astonishing that this bill, this last bill, had like 20% approval rating. It was going to affect millions of Americans in terms of health care coverage. It was 1/6 of the economy that was going to be disrupted or changed in some way. And yet here we have this bill like another bill before it kind of rammed through Congress. And they had just until Saturday to do something. And the three votes that were obvious no's were Collins, Paul, and McCain. I note that Susan Collins was a former state insurance commissioner in Maine. And she gets this issue. And I thought she had a lot of thoughtful remarks on what was wrong with it.
Kyle, help me understand something. Why we had John McCain saying, let's go back to regular order. Let's have hearings. Let's vet a bill properly and get something that's meaningful. And even more important, in this, when he announced he was not going to vote for this measure, he said, we will never be able to do anything lasting if we do it along party line votes, which is what the problem was with Obamacare. Democrats voted for it. Republicans didn't. So Republicans get in power and they're going to throw it out. And the same, there's no reason to think the same wouldn't happen if Democrats assume power again, should Republicans pass. What is wrong with regular order, Kyle? And why won't the Republican leaders try it that way?
I don't think there's anything wrong with regular
order. Okay.
I think it is the way they should have approached this from the beginning. At the same time, I do not share Senator McCain's faith that regular order would yield some sort of bipartisan bill that would pass with a significant number of Democratic votes and thus become this sort of lasting piece of law. I just don't believe that. I think the two parties are far too apart on this issue. I think the greatest merit to this bill, to the Graham-Cassidy approach, is to recognize that trying to make health policy for 320 million Americans at one time is probably a task that's doomed to perennial revision, like you're talking about, and that letting the states control more of this policy than they do now and than they have in the past is probably the only way you end up with any sets of durable policies. It might be 50 sets of durable policies. Maybe not all 50 will be durable, but I don't see a federal policy on healthcare coming from the right, coming from the left, something that is sort of mashed together from both sides being any more durable than politically durable
so
than Obamacare.
So here's what's interesting about what you just said. It is conceivable that you're going to have a hard time creating a bipartisan bill. But, Melita, that's precisely what Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, and Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, were trying to cobble together when their efforts were stopped dead in their tracks because of the Graham-Cassidy bill. Do you think Kyle is right that you can't find a bipartisan approach to this?
I would disagree with him only because I believe the last time we had a budget problem, it was a group of women senators from both parties who met behind closed doors and came up with a solution. It was always the women like Murkowski and Collins who took the leadership on most of these past failed attempts to repeal and replace. The women have shown the courage and fortitude to stand up to the party establishment and say, no, this is not a good idea. This would hurt the people of my state. So I think if you see the women like Collins and Murkowski getting with Patty Murray and some of the other women senators and meeting behind closed doors again, there could be a bipartisan bill.
Yeah, but Andy, that's, you know, we get Melita's theme today, and it's perfectly fine. But you've got to, you know, the Republicans found how hard it is to appeal just to their own spectrum of political thinkers within their party. The notion of a bipartisan approach, however well-meaning and committed the women might be, is still going to be tough to do anything about, isn't it?
Well, the bottom line here, Bill, is the ACA is still out there. And
yeah,
these health insurance exchanges are still going to operate next year. And what Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray were trying to do, and then they got stopped by Graham-Cassidy, essentially, is to kind of stabilize these insurance markets by guaranteeing that these insurers will get these subsidies, which they then pass on to consumers to lower their deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. Just about everybody can agree to that, and Republicans and Democrats. But whether that process gets restarted now is an open question. Meanwhile, you have these insurance exchanges are going to start enrolling people
yeah.
November 1.
I'm glad you brought that up because that's a good transition for us. So we don't know. We imagine, as you say, that Republicans will continue as long as they're in the majority to try to find a repeal and replace bill that they can finally pass and therefore live up to the commitments they've made to their donors and their voters. But Andy, in the meantime, you started the conversation. There are some crucial things happening in just the next days in terms of healthcare as it exists right now. One of them, as you've said, is insurance companies turning to states with their plans for what they're going to do about rates. Georgia's facing that situation right now. And with the instability of Washington on this, what are we looking for? What do you imagine is going to happen here in Georgia, for instance?
Well, already insurers, and we'll find out more actually by the end of the day when the final rates will become public, but insurers are already looking at anywhere from 15 to 40% to 50% increases in premiums for people who don't have job-based coverage and get these individual policies or family policies on the exchange. Now, that said, most people, 85% of people on the exchange get subsidies, and those subsidies will go up as the premiums go up. So they'll be cushioned from these increases, but it's the people that on the exchanges who don't get those subsidies, they're really going to get socked with much higher prices.
So that comes up. Now, but let me ask you about the subsidy. And you all jump in if you isn't there some question as to whether HHS and the president have some leeway in those subsidies, yes or no?
Well, Trump has hinted that he would remove those subsidies or cut them off to the insurance companies. And so if that happens, then you'll see many more insurance companies pull out of the marketplaces, and you'll see premiums go even higher. I haven't heard a lot of talk on that lately, so it may be that it'll just kind of continue as is, kind of indefinitely. But insurers like to have little risk. They hate high-risk situations. They hate the instability. And so they're looking to Washington almost every day to figure out what's going to happen.
Kyle?
I think the issue here, I think you will... To answer your first question, I think you'll probably see some movement to keep things from totally falling apart, in the next fiscal year. The big problem is, why are these companies requesting these increases? They're requesting the increases because the people buying insurance tend to be older and sicker than the population that Obamacare was designed to draw into the exchange. The younger and healthier people haven't been buying it. That's not going to improve after these premiums go up. And yes, the subsidies will cushion a lot of people from those effects, but the people who aren't cushioned are going to be tempted to just pay the penalty anyway. You know, we've had 6-7 million people a year doing that as it is, instead of buying in the exchange. This isn't going to get better. And back to the Alexander Murray thing, I think, based on everything I've been able to gather, the reason that wasn't happening is because you had the Democrats on the one side saying, okay, we want these cost-sharing responsibility, or whatever, the CSR, the subsidies. It was very unclear what the Republicans were getting in exchange. There was some maybe vague, a little bit more state control, but it was all going to be within the regulatory framework that Obama set up. And the whole criticism of Graham Cassidy was that it would maybe allow the states to ask for different ways to go about this, not to eliminate pre-existing conditions, but to find a different approach to that problem than Obamacare prescribed. So this is where I get back to what bipartisan agreement is there going to be?
Right.
There's nothing about Alexander Murray that made me think the Democrats were moving anywhere close to where the Republicans might say yes, and they still have 52 senators. I think for every Democrat you pick up that way, you probably lose two Republicans.
All right. So, but let me throw this out. It is certainly the case. Obamacare, one of the most important tenets of Obamacare, Melita, was everybody had to join an exchange or pay a penalty. Kyle points out that younger people seem to be willing to pay a penalty. That's one of the things that needs to be fixed.
Well, and the penalties were so much less than the premiums for the insurance. And so that's why young people chose not to join. But I think the other thing about health care, and Atul Gawande in a new piece for The New Yorker this week points out that lower income Americans who are working are now paying so much in their insurance premiums and their high deductibles that they look at those who get free insurance or free health care through Medicaid and wonder why they're working. He does a good job of looking at how middle America sees health care and Obamacare. It's well worth the read for these thinking public radio listeners.
We'll see if we can find a link to it and put it up on the website. So Obamacare is the law of the land. It will be. Insurance companies are going to, we're going to have rates set. It's going to be more and more expensive. There's questions, Andy, as whether the Trump administration and Secretary Price are doing everything they can to support ACA at this point, beyond the money, in terms of promoting it, encouraging people to join up. So we don't know where that's headed. But we have a couple of other crucial programs here in Georgia, as states around the country do, that are facing significant deadlines at the end of this week. One of them is is the CHIP program. Here in Georgia, we refer to it as Peach Care. It's been an enormously, I think I'm right to say, Andy, popular program. This is the program that provides financial aid to children whose families live in lower incomes, right?
Right, lower and middle incomes. It's for kids whose parents are above the Medicaid kind of area where the kid would be under Medicaid. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit higher income. Very popular nationally as well as in Georgia. You have about 180,000 kids covered by it. But come October 1, those funds are going to be cut off if the Congress doesn't renew that program. And there's also other programs that are facing a cutoff. Now, there's still money in the hopper to cover those kids for a few months here in Georgia and in other states. But that's not an indefinite promise, and that's not... Unless they renew this program and some other programs, eventually the money's going to go away.
How much money does Georgia get for Peach Care? Do you know the basic amount?
It's over $200 million. I think it might be in the area of $400 million. And that's federal money.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. Yeah. Yes.
To
absolutely.
Cover here in the state, do we know the population of young people, children who are covered by
about
this?
About 185,000.
Oh, it's here in Georgia.
Yeah, here in Georgia. Nationally, it's millions.
I apologize.
No, that's fine.
I got you. Kyle, we're already at September 27th. Is Congress moving on this stuff?
I got that. Two words for you, continuing resolution.
Yeah.
I think that's your safest bet at this point as to what we're going to see happen between now and Saturday.
Yeah.
And you've got indigent care money going to hospitals. That's also up for grabs. You got millions of dollars going to community health centers that needs to be renewed as well. And you have a pot of money for rural hospitals that's up for grabs as well. And all these programs run out this weekend.
So let's talk about those. Let's break them down just a little bit for the sake of our listeners, because it's an interesting discussion, I think. One of those programs you talked about is subsidies for what I call charity hospitals like Grady. There's been and it's something both Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue worked hard to try to protect during the second round of talks about repeal and replace. This is money that goes to hospitals that have an inordinate share of patients who cannot pay their bills, who are definitely in poverty, and the government has subsidized those hospitals, right?
Right. It's high numbers of, if you're serving high numbers of Medicaid patients and uninsured patients, you get this money. It's called DSH. It's disproportionate share hospital funding. Grady gets a lot of this money, and the cut would be, if this money absolutely goes away, the cut in Georgia for the first year is something like $36 million for hospitals. Of that total, the cut to Grady would be $10 million to $13 million. And that Grady's doing a whole lot better financially, but that would be a big hit to their bottom line.
Melina?
The other thing you have to think about with these hospitals is how many rural hospitals in Georgia have closed and how difficult it is for a community to attract industry when they've lost a hospital. There are people in South Georgia who have to drive an hour and a half to deliver a baby. And so the failing rural hospitals is not just a health care problem. It's an economic development problem for rural Georgia.
Yeah. Andy, what is the subsidy for rural hospitals that needs to be renewed?
Well, it's complicated. It's called a low volume adjustment. And it basically goes to 24 hospitals in our state that have a low number of Medicare discharges. And it sounds like a very complicated thing, but it's real money to some of these hospitals. It's a total of $10 million to these 24 hospitals, and it ranges anywhere from like $30,000 up to over $1 million. And for these hospitals that are struggling financially to kind of make some of them to even make payroll, this can
Where
make
are
a
some
little
of
bit
them?
Of a difference.
Where are some of them?
Well, they're all over the state.
Okay.
They're in South Georgia, probably primarily South and Central Georgia, but they're all over. And this is money that is you know, is not a lot has been written about this, but this is real. This is real, can have a real impact on some of these facilities.
I remember there were some bad tornadoes in my home county, Cook County, near Adel. And that hospital was slated to close. And those people had to be airlifted to Thomasville or Macon, the ones who were injured in the tornado. So it really is a serious problem for some of these rural areas.
Kyle, you know, we spend so much of our time focusing on the repeal and replace measures, and yet these other programs we're talking about now have such an enormous impact on people. And it is primarily Republicans who have questions about extending benefits like this. Is that the right place for Republicans to be? We already know that repeal and replace, the versions we've seen, have been unpopular in the polls. Do Republicans want to be in this place where they are reluctant to vote for extending these subsidies?
Now, I'm not sure they're terribly reluctant on this. I mean, you mentioned Senators Isaacson and Perdue.
Yes, they've worked hard on it.
Both worked on the DSH issue. You know, we have to remember there's two reasons the DSH payments are an issue. One is that Obamacare got rid of them in anticipation of all states expanding Medicaid, and then the second one is Georgia not expanding Medicaid. So this isn't an issue in every state the way it is in a state like Georgia that is still receiving these DSH payments. You know, we talked about regular order before. I would think that a bill that goes through that process the next several months, I would hope, would take into consideration these sorts of issues, try to come up with solutions to them that are more amenable to the states than sort of this lose this money or take this expense, which is what the way a state like Georgia saw the Medicaid expansion versus the DSH payments.
I've got to get another break in. Excuse me. Andy, you in partnership, Georgia Health News in partnership with Huffington Post, did an extraordinary piece of reporting about the rural health care crisis in Georgia, a little bit of which we touched on here. But I really want to encourage our listeners to go to the Georgia Health. It's easy to find, Georgia Health News. Just what is your actual URL? They can Google it.
GeorgiaHealthNews.com, and there are no paywalls. You can go right to it. You don't have to pay
read
your story.
We're not going to have time to go into it in depth, but it was a remarkable and important piece of journalism and really tells us a lot about the kind of crisis that we're facing right now. And again, ACA and repealing and replacing have gotten all the headlines, but it's these other issues too. Which are so important for the good health of any state. We got to get a break in. When we come back, we'll continue. We're going to talk a little bit about President Trump because you're not tired of Trump in the NFL, are you? Nobody is.
On the next Fresh Air, the new HBO series The Deuce about 42nd Street in the early 70s when it was a strip for prostitutes, pimps, and peep shows. It follows the money and who exploits and who gets exploited. Our guests will be the show's creators, David Simon, who also created The Wire and Tremé, and George Pelicanos, who wrote for both of those shows. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
You know, we had a pretty extensive conversation on Monday about Trump and the NFL as because it was so much in the headlines. And you gave us an awful lot of feedback. And I want to tell you that what became clear is that this issue matters. It's a hot button issue. It's a divisive issue. And it's not going away anytime soon, I don't think. So let's spend a little time on it right now. President Trump had a news conference yesterday. It was one of those joint news conferences with the Prime Minister of Spain, right? Yeah. And he was asked a question that some people have been raising lately, which is, why did he spend so much more time over the last days tweeting about NFL players who take a knee and not calling attention to the crisis in Puerto Rico as a result of the devastation of Hurricane Maria? Here's what he said.
Well, I wasn't preoccupied with the NFL. I was ashamed of what was taking place because, to me, that was a very important moment. I don't think you can disrespect our country, our flag, our national anthem. To me, the NFL situation is a very important situation. I've heard that before about, was I preoccupied? Not at all. Not at all. I have plenty of time on my hands. All I do is work.
All right. Kyle Wingfield. Why does the president choose to continue this conversation?
I think it's probably politically good for him. I think the part of his base that he cannot lose loves this. And I think in addition to that, there's a larger group of people who don't necessarily agree with him about a lot of things, but think he's basically right about this issue, that standing at attention during the national anthem is something that Americans are supposed to do. I think this is another one of those issues where people kind of look at him and say, why is he fighting this issue? And the answer is because there's a certain segment of Americans that want to see someone fighting for this type of stance. Now, does it get us anywhere as a country? I don't really think so. And he did, a byproduct of this is it went from something like six people kneeling a week ago to every NFL team doing something.
Including Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys, who had initially come out and said, I don't like my players being disrespectful of the flag. And yet Jerry Jones himself in the Dallas game linked arms with his players and reflected that concern.
But I think it sort of redounds back to Trump. I think he actually... Who comes out of this actually better in a more solid position? I think he may be more than anybody.
Melita, this is one of those kind of head-spinning issues. The president suggests that showing respect, you're showing disrespect for the flag and the country if you don't stand for the national anthem. And yet, of course, one of the things that we value most about this country is free speech. And you could also argue that players who take a knee in some ways are less disrespectful, say, than the Olympic athletes who raise their fists. I think the question I'm asking is, by oversimplifying this, is the president making it worse?
In some ways, I think he might be. But you have to also remember there are also a lot of pictures of the president not having his hand over his heart while the national anthem is being played. And the other thing is that his kerfuffle about this diverts attention from the very real problems the people of Puerto Rico were facing, from the very real investigation that Mueller continues to do. So when he can stir up a storm of public opinion and attention away from that investigation, which grows ever closer to his inner circle, then he achieves the goal he set out to do.
To the extent the response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico depends on America's attention, you may be right, but there's pretty much every indication I've seen that the federal government is there doing what they can do at this point. And let me be clear, there's more that needs to be done than they can do right now. I mean, I've read something, it's 80-something percent of their transmission lines were destroyed. And I mean, it is a gargantuan task, but there's been no indication that the federal government is not acting as it would normally because of this NFL situation.
I think some of it was slow in coming. And I think the other thing that I've not seen in any media is Puerto Rico gives an opportunity for perhaps looking outside the box of the traditional grid for communications, for electrical transmission, looking outside the box and figuring out how you best serve those people quickly with solar and wind and some of the other ways to help them without the traditional grid.
Bill, I think that, I'm a First Amendment guy. And I think a lot of conservatives who've complained about the NFL players, they've also been pushing hard to have their speakers speak on university campuses. That's been a big issue for conservatives. And so I think that it has to be fairly done here in terms of, okay, these players are exhibiting their First Amendment rights. Does it make us uncomfortable? Yeah. But I think that the players' original protest was about social injustice, inequality, and police brutality. But I think Trump's remarks made it more about Trump, actually.
You know, I want to just say something quickly because we're close to running out of time. But it did not escape me that there is something interesting about all this, that this controversy over kneeling when the national anthem is being played comes even as Ken Burns' series on the Vietnam War is unfolding on PBS. I was a young man during Vietnam, and I think I can safely say there were many people who protested the war who believed they were great patriots for doing just that, and yet the country was torn apart because neither side understood one another. And Kyle, I think this is obviously a much smaller scale and not the kind of awesome event that Vietnam was, but it's a similar thing.
I think you're right about that, and I think the players who are participating in this protest would say, you're wrong about us if you think this is about disrespecting this country and this flag. And I think the people who are critical of them would say, well, you're wrong about us if you think this is about race from our perspective. I do think it's a situation of two groups of people talking completely past each other.
Got to give you the last word that we are out of time on today's show. Kyle Wingfield, it's a victory. I got the last word. Melita Easters, thank you for being here.
Good luck
with your event on Monday. Andy Miller, again, people should go read on Georgia Health News the remarkable story you did on rural hospitals in the state. And thank you for being with us. And,
thanks,
you know, we always want you to come back when we got health care on our minds. So tomorrow we're going to be here for Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock. We have a really different, but I hope interesting show for you. Emory University's Center for Ethics has just launched a year-long project to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, A Modern Prometheus. They did that because they will tell you that from their point of view, Frankenstein the novel is all about ethical questions and concerns. And if you read it, I think you'll find they're right. So we're going to do a show about that. We were at a big event they did at the Schwartz Center for Performing Arts last week. They asked me to be there to interview an artist, an Atlanta artist they commissioned to do a portrait of the Frankenstein monster. So tomorrow on Two-Way Street, we'll talk with the artist. You'll hear excerpts from the novel Frankenstein. And we'll talk about what those ethical issues are. That's Two-Way Street at 2. And then Friday, of course, we're back at 3 o'clock with another Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. See you for all of that in the days ahead.
Thank
you, guys.
Sir.